are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 13th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Political Science at George Washington University, John Sides, co-author of Identity Crisis, the 2016 presidential campaign and the battle for meaning of America. Also on the program today, that blue wave got a little wavier. Kristen Sinema declared the winner in Arizona as the Republican candidate refuses to pretend that there was voter fraud there. Meanwhile, speaking of fraud, Matt Whitaker's appointment faces a new court challenge as he is pretending to be acting attorney general. Rick Scott, speaking of pretending again about voter fraud, tries to end the recount in Florida, but fails. Meanwhile, in Georgia, a judge orders a halt to the election certification so that provisional ballots may be reviewed. Reports are Trump going to fire Christian Nielsen, wants Chris Kobach. Meanwhile, Jerome Corsi and Roger Stone think they'll be indicted today. We should be so lucky. Democrats announce their early legislative agenda, and it's smart. Meanwhile, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calls for more stringent requirements on Amazon's invasion of Queens. Trump re-ups his covering for Mohammed bin Salman, and Gavin McGinnis is having a tough time in Larchmont. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry for the slight delay today in the beginning of the show. Having technical, all sorts of technical difficulties, and it's there's really nothing that irritates me more. If it goes past like an hour's worth of technical difficulties, then I think it's basically my whole day a shot. So
there is one other thing that it's that it irritates you more, if I may.
Well, that's possibly true.
Dishonoring white women.
That's a reference to a call that we had yesterday. This interview is going to be fascinating today. There was just a couple of just general statistics that I just was unaware of, and this dynamic that the argument that this book makes in terms of what Barack Obama and Donald Trump did to what identity was activated by people in terms of race is fascinating. I'll explain that more when we get into the show. But as we speak, the votes are being counted, recounted in Florida. Very close in the Senate race, a little bit less so in the governor's race, but obviously close enough for a recount. It's unclear to me how it's going to work in terms of the recount with the Senate at this point. I can't quite tell if it's going to be a machine recount, and if the machine recount brings it down to a certain level, then it becomes a hand recount. Conceivably, that could happen in the governor's race, too. Seems unlikely. But there is a certain amount of undervotes for the Senate race in Broward County. And I've seen two forms of speculation. One is that it was a flaw in the ballot design. So people missed voting for the Senate. The second was that there was a flaw in the ballot design and the machine missed recording that people had voted for it. So we'll see. I mean, it feels at the very least, it feels that the Democrats are slightly more prepared for this. It's absurd that there could ever be any voting problems in Florida again after 2000. Right? I mean, this would be like, we're going to build another bad levee in New Orleans. That's up next.
Careful what you wish for.
So people went back, and there was a documentary called Unprecedented, not to be confused with Cliff Schechter's podcast. And it was the 2000 presidential election documentary that looked at the voting irregularities in West Palm Beach. And somebody went back, watched it, saw a recognizable individual who was interviewed at the time. At that time, he was involved in student government. This is, this is only 18 years ago, I guess.
But when election day came, there were unexpected obstacles.
As the precincts closed later that evening, we began to get reports here in the Student Government Association from just different students about either not having their voter registration card, going to their precinct that they had voted at before, and now being told that they weren't on the roster, that their names have been purged.
Many more irregularities were confirmed when the NAACP held hearings a few days.
Yeah, I'll say. But there it is. Andrew Gillum, at the time involved in student government. That's crazy.
Not a single word about single payer.
There you go.
You can see the roots of the loss right there.
He did not say a word about single payer.
Not a single word about free college tuition.
There it is. Andrew Gillum. Full circle, right?
Ignoring the key issues back then and today.
It is.
Whining about voter suppression.
But it is.
Ignoring economic populism.
It is stunning that we still have election, that we could possibly have election problems in Florida in the same areas. That the laws have not been amended in any way. That if you're up against the deadline, you haven't finished counting votes because there's been screw-ups, that those votes don't count? It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
Well, and clearly it's working for some people.
Indeed. Let me just finish here. The Democrats have announced their legislative agenda, at least their early one. And they will be introducing legislation to do some things that I actually also mentioned would be a good idea to do. So I may even give myself a little bit of a dab here. The bill would establish automatic voter registration and reinvigorate the Voting Rights Act. I think you'll recall I was hoping that the Democrats would do that. So this right there.
You can make it a little more enthusiastic. There we go. A little upper.
Look,
wait till
you throw it away. You throw it away.
Sure. Whatever you say.
It would take redistricting power away from state legislatures and give it to independent commissions. It would go on other provisions, overturn Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. Not quite sure how they could go about doing that, but they could mandate more disclosure of outside money and establish public financing match for small contributions. That to me seems to be fine. But I think basically, you know, they understand. And then there's some ethics issues, too, that seem to be focused on Donald Trump. But you would imagine no one would have a problem with expanding anti-bribery laws. One would imagine. One would probably be wrong, but we'll see. The bottom line, though, however, is that the Democrats are stepping forward with an agenda that does two things. One, because this is not going to pass, right? The Senate is not going to pass this. It's controlled by the Republicans. But it does two things. One, if it was to be passed, it would make structural reforms that would enhance the power of Democrats and their ability to get elected and neutralize, at least to some extent, the ability of Republicans from disenfranchising tens to hundreds of thousands to millions of people across the country and keeping them from voting. That's A. B, what if it does not pass, it's going to force Republican senators to vote against things like fixing the Voting Rights Act, like making it easier to vote, like anti-bribery statutes. It's going to draw some clear lines as to what the Republicans are for and against and what the Democrats are for and against. So it's a smart piece of legislation. I might break it up personally, but I don't know how they're going to introduce it. But they have a large package. They may do it as an omnibus bill, which it makes some votes more difficult for the Republicans. They may not. So we'll see.
Dab on them haters.
There you go. Meanwhile, folks, it is the flu and cold season. Staying properly hydrated is one of the most important factors in recovering from the flu and cold and, frankly, from avoiding it. Thankfully, Liquid IV provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Liquid IV is not your average electrolyte drink mix. It has 110% daily value of vitamin C and B12. It's non-GMO, clean ingredients, healthy alternative to traditional sports drinks, and it delivers hydration to the bloodstream faster and more efficiently than water does. That's because of chemistry. I think B12 causes like stuff like vitamin C and some of the nutrients to be absorbed quicker. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. With 5 essential vitamins, it has more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. Whenever I travel now, I grab a handful. I take one on the plane. I take one when I get off the plane. Sometimes I'll do one when I get on the plane. I stay properly hydrated, don't have jet lag. And occasionally when I travel, I will drink a little too much. And so I will drink one that night.
Think it feels good for my tummy. drink.
I don't even know what that
picturing
is.
Picturing Sam getting blitzed on a plane. He's trying to start an
argument. I don't drink alcohol on a plane.
About zero sum with somebody across the aisle.
I love Liquid IV, and I know you will too, as Michael just did my voice when I drink it. Right now, my listeners get 20% off at liquidiv.com. So it's liquid-iv.com. When you use my code MAJORITY at checkout, that's 20% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquid-iv.com and enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquid-iv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. Also, support for today's show comes from Third Love. Using millions of real women's measurements, Third Love designs its bras with breast size and shape in mind for an impeccable fit and incredible feel. All you do is you answer a few simple questions from Third Love's Fit Finder quiz to find your perfect fit. Third Love offers double the number of sizes that most brands offer, cups A through H, bands up to 48. And with lightweight memory foam cups, straps that won't slip, tagless labels, you want to wear these soft and breathable bras and underwear every day, especially the new cotton t-shirt bras and underwear. Thanks to the 100% fit guarantee, returns and exchanges are free and easy. I have a testimonial about Third Love. What are you? Are you 4?
I think actually a little, like maybe more like 9.
9. Yeah, I would say 9. Okay, so this is a close friend of mine who tried out the bras. I like they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered 2. Both fit. That almost never happens. I don't have the experience to know if she's just, you know, talking or what, but she says that almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. There you go. Third love, folks. They know there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now and find your perfect fitting bra. They can get 15% off your first purchase. That's Third Love, spelled out thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. And lastly, I think you all know that 2018 has been a rather difficult year for human rights. Frankly, 2017, 2016, 2015, we could go on, has not been so great either. But have you ever wondered how rights abuses are documented around the world? You probably have. The sheer volume of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders. It's critical we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. I can't tell you how many times on this program I have quoted Human Rights Watch numbers. For this program, and frankly, 15 some odd years I've been doing this. They're an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy. Often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups, they accept no money from any government, but rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, go to hrw.org/majority. Make a donation, support its vital work around the world. That's hrw.org/majority. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. It's a great thing to do, to sit down with your kids. And, you know, this, as we enter into sort of like the gift gearing, giving season, to sit down with them. And I mean, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but what I do with my kids is we take a night of Hanukkah, and instead of getting a toy, the cash, they get to choose. We look at a couple of charities, charitable organizations. And so, great way to sort of enter into some conversations with kids. hrw.org/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, John Sides. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at George Washington University, co-author with Michael Tesler and Lynn Vavarick of Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Battle for the Meaning of America. John Sides, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start this story of the 2016 election really starts closer to 2008. And I want to just start with one fact that that sort of blew me away, was that less than 50% of non-college educated white voters could place the Democrats to the left of the Republicans on the question of which party was more supportive of government assistance, I guess broadly, help for African Americans. Is that right? And what are the implications of that at that time?
What that's showing you is of course, that lots of people just don't pay close attention to politics and don't register features of political parties that to most political observers are well-known and have been well-known for years, if not decades. The reason that this changes, though, has to do with the presidency of Barack Obama. And in some sense, Barack Obama clarifies the party politics of race, and this helps voters who may have been paying less attention to politics come to realize that the Democratic Party is to the left of the Republican Party on these issues.
That, to me, is stunning, because there was plenty of I've seen studies that suggest that the idea of government support becomes racialized right before this. But it's not lined up with the parties until essentially people see that a black guy is the Democratic nominee.
Yeah, especially for voters who had less formal education, the alignment of their partisanship and their racial attitudes really was a feature of the Obama era. And what that did, of course, overall was just to strengthen the correlation in the American population more generally, so that people who have views of immigration that are more favorable or want more immigration, or people that have views of racial inequality that think that it has mostly to do with slavery and discrimination, those people are increasingly Democrats. And if you have a view that is more concerned about the level of immigration and wants to reduce it, or if you have a view of racial inequality that says that it's mostly about blacks not trying hard enough or not working hard enough, then those people are increasingly Republicans. You know, so maybe people are changing their views about immigration to match their partisanship, or maybe they're updating their partisanship to align with their views of race and immigration. But either way, you know, we end up with a country where the standard way that we contest elections, you know, Democrat versus Republican, is now not just a debate about, let's say, how large government should be, which it has been for years and years and years. Now it's a debate about, you know, what kind of country we're going to be, how exclusive or inclusive we're going to be toward these different kinds of groups.
And I mean, in some ways, like, I feel that some of us here, I'm speaking literally in this room, have been guilty of assuming that these things were already racialized, right? I mean, because race has played such an enormous part in our politics. But I guess so the big difference is really just sort of this new level of sorting that's taking place, right? That has been really basically an 8 to 10 year process.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's no question that racial politics have been endemic in American politics from the founding. But the ways in which people's views about race and their own racial identities align with partisanship is a much more recent phenomenon.
And even like in the context of like the Dixiecrats and whatnot, and LBJ saying we're going to lose the South because of these issues for a decade, he turned out to be a little bit off. But even then, I mean, this is it all comes down. Well, let's just start with this. I mean, where do you guys, tell us about the research that you did that you started to come across this notion. Did you enter into this work with an awareness that this dynamic had taken place?
Yes. I mean, in part because my co-author, Michael Tesler, had previously written two different books about the politics of race during the Obama era, one about his 2008 presidential campaign, and then a second book about his, not only his presidential campaigns, but his presidency more generally. And we knew this was happening. And there are some, you know, there's been a lot of attention in the political science literature to this concept of sorting and to the ways in which Democrats and Republicans, may increasingly differ from each other on a variety of policy issues. But what Michael was able to show in his work on the Obama era was that this sorting came to encompass racial issues as well as more general kinds of ideological issues. However, I think that this more general trend toward sorting may or may not have been as consequential in 2016 had it not been for the 2016 campaign itself. I mean, there was plenty of sorting already underway by the 2012, but yet the role of issues like immigration and race in 2016 was clearly greater than in 2012, or that's what our evidence suggests. And that tells you that a lot of it had to do with the specific choices of the candidates in terms of their ideas and messages in 2016 and how those differed from other recent presidential elections.
Okay, so conceptually, to understand this, it's almost as if there was like a dormant virus embedded in all of us, and the environment in 2012 or 2008 brought that to the fore, and then in 2012 it was a little bit less. The environment was a little bit less stimulating to that virus, and then in 2016, that virus or allergy or however you want to conceptualize it, what was even magnified because of the context. Is that sort of like conceptually the right way to think about that?
I think that's right. I mean, sometimes we talk about it with kind of an agricultural metaphor, which is, aspects of the Obama era kind of fertilized the soil for a more racially charged politics. And that made probably increased the likelihood that that kind of racially charged politics could be potent if the candidates were to really embrace that. And Obama obviously didn't. He was always trying to moderate on questions of race. He didn't talk about it as frequently as some other Democratic presidents. He took very careful positions. You know, McCain and Romney, really did not want to run heavily racialized campaigns and explicitly rejected certain kinds of tactics that might have played the race card in a more explicit way. But of course, for Trump and Clinton, it was a very different kind of election altogether.
All right. Well, let's talk about that in terms of, because my understanding is that Clinton found herself relative from 2008 to 2016, the way that she was perceived on race and as reflected in her supporters almost flipped. Is that right?
Yes. Basically, of course, in 2008, her coalition was built around primarily white voters in the Democratic primaries, and especially white voters who had more conservative views on racial issues. And in 2016, it flips that now her coalition, she gains all this support among African Americans, loses some support among whites overall. And the role of white primary voters' racial attitudes just doesn't really matter as much anymore, because there's no African American candidate on the ballot, and Clinton and Sanders are not really different in their own views about racial inequality. So yeah, it was basically a coalition that became the inverse of itself.
So how do you measure this stuff? Because 2008, it's not. We had our first black presidential candidate. We also were coming out of or entering into, the most severe economic, event in generations. How do you sort of parse this stuff out? Like, how do you determine what is operative? What is, because I imagine there's a lot of things that go into, the question of who am I going to vote for? How do you parse these out, and how do you determine what is the sort of the driving factor?
Sure. What we did in looking at the 2016 election was we did as many comparisons to recent presidential elections as we could, because we wanted to distinguish what is distinctive about 2016 from what is kind of a chronically important factor in presidential elections. In which case, if it's chronically important, then the story isn't really about 2016. It's just a broader story about American presidential elections. One of the ways that we did this was with a unique survey that interviewed the same group of voters first in the 2012 election. We talked to them in December 2011, so you know almost a year before they voted. And we talked to them in November 2012 after they had voted, and we asked them, you know, did you vote Obama or did you vote Romney? And then 4 years later, right after the 2016 election, we were able to re-interview those same voters. And so we could see, you know, how they voted in both elections and who shifted from Obama to Trump or from Romney to Clinton. And we could compare the relative impact of their views about a variety of different issues that we had measured way back in 2011, you know, well before, you know, both campaigns, but especially 2016. And we found that it was these things about race and immigration that although in some cases they certainly appeared to correlate strongly with your choice from between Obama and Romney, that those correlations increased in 2016. Other factors didn't necessarily share that same pattern.
How do you, like, I mean, what are the type of questions that you ask to make that determination where you pull it apart?
Very good question. Very good question. So, like, we can break up a couple different topics. Take racial inequality. You know, we're asking people whether they agree or disagree with a series of statements. And the statements are designed to get at, do you attribute racial inequality to structural forces like discrimination, or do you attribute it to the fact that, you know, to your belief that blacks don't work hard enough? So generations of slavery and discrimination have made it difficult for blacks to get ahead. That's, you know, do you agree or disagree? Or you may ask them, it's just a question of trying harder. If blacks would only try hard enough, they could be as well off as whites. Do you agree or disagree? So we ask those kinds of questions to measure views of immigration. You know, the three questions that we had in the survey when we first did it in 2011 were, do you want to increase or decrease immigration? Do you want to, or keep it the same? You know, and then do you support a path of citizenship for undocumented immigrants? And then thirdly, do you think that undocumented immigrants are a benefit or drain on society? So, you know, we combine these questions together to get, you know, kind of indexes or scales that measure people's views on these issues. To do one more example, where there's a lot of discussion about the role of economics and economic anxiety. And so in both 12 and 16, this is now in a different survey project, but a really nice battery of questions. How worried are you about losing your job? How likely is it that you're not going to be able to make a mortgage or rent payment in the coming months or not be able to make a health care payment? Several questions of that nature. So really designed to get at the what I think people really thought were the driving insecurities, even after 8 years of economic recovery since the recession. And we just found that those economic anxiety measures really didn't strongly correlate with your vote in either election, 12 or 16, and didn't correlate more strongly in 16 than 12.
Were there significant differences in the way that people answered those questions? So you're asking the same people in 2011 that you are in 2016. Do their answers change at all? I mean, did you see any, like, did people become more or less, express more or less, I guess, racist views or, you know, however you want
to? Sure, very good question. Overall, no. There aren't really big shifts in people's overall views about immigration or race or things like that. One of the metaphors that we use to illustrate this, sometimes people talk about Trump's victory or the success of right-wing populist parties in European countries as a wave. It's a wave of populist sentiment. But if by populist sentiment you mean things like concern about immigration, you know, there is no wave. It's not that, like, the public was becoming less open to immigration, and that's what Trump was able to ride to victory. What we would say is that public opinion on questions like race and immigration and other issues is really more like a reservoir. You know, there's a range of sentiments from positive to negative or favorable to unfavorable. And the question is, are those sentiments going to be mobilized and therefore become more powerfully predictive of people's choices? And again, that's where the decisions of the candidates come in.
So it's, and let me ask the same question about the economic anxiety measures.
Sure.
Was there any movement from 2011 to 2016?
The American public became less economically anxious, which again it's a mystery to me why this was so undercovered going into the 2016 election. But there have been, 50 years of survey data that ask people things like, how are your personal finances doing? Are they getting better or worse? What about the national economy? Do you think it's getting better or worse? What about in a year from now? Do you think you'll be better then or worse off then? The standard battery of questions showed pretty clearly that the public was getting more economically confident. And again, this is just tracking the actual the recovery from the recession. It's not to suggest that like every problem had been solved,
right?
But in terms of what the public was seeing, it clearly reflected a belief that the economy was getting better. And what's been remarkable to me is that since Trump's gotten elected, there's much more news coverage now about the economic recovery, the growth rate, the unemployment rate, people with positive views. Now the question is, why isn't the positive economy helping Trump or helping the Republican Party? But if you look at people's actual views about the economy, they're only a little bit better than they were in 2016. So again, I think in some sense, the popular impression of the campaign really missed the boat on what was happening in public opinion overall.
And was that improved perspective on the economy, was that equally distributed across, different income levels and wealth levels and all different sort of subgroups that you would look at?
Very good question. So the answer is yes, that you can segment the public based on how much formal education they have. You can segment them based on their income level. And the trends are moving in parallel. So like every group, every educational group and income group is becoming more favorable about the economy. And in fact, the ironic thing about the comparisons across the income groups is that during the Obama years, there were actually fewer differences between the wealthiest and the least wealthy Americans in their views of the economy. So in some sense, the income differences shrank during Obama, far from it being the case that they were growing because the wealthy people thought the economy was doing much better, but the poor people thought it wasn't. The only really thing that differentiates people's perceptions of the economy overall is just partisanship. And, Democrats and Democratic-leaning people were much more likely to perceive that economic growth than Republicans because the Republicans didn't want to give credit to a Democratic president. And this kind of partisan bias in economic perceptions is a pretty chronic feature of contemporary American politics. So if you wanted to find the really angry people or the so-called economically anxious people, it was really Republicans tired of being out of the White House for 8 years. It wasn't due to social class or income or anything like that.
And much of your research suggests that race or that party becomes a surrogate for racial questions. Is that right? I mean, is that?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, so explain that to us.
The party becomes a surrogate
racial views that you have, that like the more things become racialized. I mean, so just even getting back to the immigration point you were making. People had the same feelings towards immigration. It's just that they didn't realize they could express them in like the political arena. Is that a way of conceiving?
I'd maybe put it slightly differently. I mean, they express them. I mean, they'll tell you their views. I mean, at least if you believe survey data. But again, like.
But you can't act on them. You can actually act on them within the context of politics. And they didn't understand that before?
Well, I mean, I think from the standpoint of social science, right? If there's a lot of different ingredients that can go into my choice between a Democratic and Republican candidate, and we know that partisanship is always going to be a factor, and it was a strong factor in 2016, as it has been in previous elections. But the question is, other factors, well, it depends, right? It depends on, first of all, what are the candidates talking about? Are you getting enough information to think that this is an important issue? What positions are the candidates taking? If they're taking the same position, then it doesn't really help you choose to think about that issue because they're not, you know, they're carbon copies of each other. So again, what I think makes a difference for voters is to see, first of all, a lot of discussion about an issue, which brings it to the top of your head and makes it a more salient part of your thinking, and then to see the candidates sharply differ on that question. And so what you saw in 2016 that was different than 2012 or 2008 was both this sort of extraordinary emphasis on all of these issues tied to race, ethnicity, and immigration, and also very, very sharp differences between Trump's positions, of course, which attracted controversy for the entire duration of the campaign, and Clinton's positions, which we argue were to the left of Obama's, probably, and more generally, of course, she was structuring her entire campaign in many ways as a rejection of Trump. And so I think if you were a voter, now you had a very clear contrast on an issue that was being discussed more frequently than it had been. So that's what makes your own views about immigration now become activated and a more important influence on your choice.
I see. So as I grow older, I may think that, you know, tax deductions for mortgages on homes are more important than I did when I was, you know, 22, I guess. But in this instance, it is outside of me. That remains a constant. And suddenly the candidates are talking about tax deductions on home mortgages and how important they are. And I may become more attuned to it at an earlier age, yep. Just for example.
Yeah. And it's not to say that people don't make choices based on factors that are, you know, kind of intrinsic or idiosyncratic to them.
Right.
I certainly also care a lot more about the mortgage interest deduction than I did 20 years ago. And it's not to say that we can reduce people's choices in 2016 or any election to one factor or one set of factors. But what I would typically say, again, is if we want to see what is distinctively important about voting behavior in one election as opposed to other elections, right, a lot of that's going to depend on the choices and the messages of the candidates.
And this was one of those things that was different than the other, essentially, is what stuck out. And so, all right, let's talk about Muslims, because during the Bush administration, we've actually had in the past couple of years, and maybe really, I mean, starting, well, I think you know this, I mean, during the Obama years, it was sort of, I mean, it was upsetting, but also fascinating to see that during the close proximity temporally to 9/11 did not provide more hate attacks against Muslims. It was really as we got further out, it was basically Obama in some way energized Islamophobia. Is that what your data shows? I certainly feel like I experienced that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that Michael Tesler talks about in his work on the Obama era in particular is that views of Muslims became more associated with views of Obama than was true for other candidates or that had been true in the past. And part of this probably reflects the idea that some people perceived Obama himself or suspected he was a Muslim. And we could show in the chapter that this may help explain why Democratic and Republican voters are now further apart in their views of Muslims and Islam than they once were. So in some sense, Islam and Muslims is another issue on which the parties are now better sorted. But then again, here comes 2016 and shows that we can have a campaign that activates your underlying views of Muslims more so than was true even in the Obama era. And this, of course, is largely due to the fact that Trump targeted Muslims for, you know, and suggested we needed new policies to deal with travel and to deal with Homeland Security and You know, he's widely criticized for those views, including within his own party. But again, it makes the contrast between him and Clinton starker, and it brings that issue to the forefront of people's minds in ways that it might not have been.
Let's talk about the sort of the how Trump acted upon those from, I guess, the center to the left, sort of in an inverse way to Obama. I mean, so if Obama basically activated people's pre-existing racial biases and Islamophobia, Trump has sort of done the opposite for people who had maybe a reservoir of less discriminatory. How would you express that?
Well, I think what you're pointing to is a really important trend that's happened during, but especially since the 2016 campaign. And what we've observed in public polling data is a remarkable leftward shift of Democrats on these issues. Really, I mean, in a very short amount of time, 2 to 3 years, we're talking about 15-point or even 20-point increases in the percentage of Democrats who, you know, express a favorable view of immigrants, increases in the percentage of Democrats who attribute racial inequality to discrimination. We're also seeing, I think, a similar sort of partisan difference in views of Islam. We, you know, it's always the case that public opinion reacts against presidents. I mean, it's kind of a chronic feature. The president sort of tries to shift policy in one direction and the public goes in the other direction almost as a reaction. But what's happened in particular under Trump is a shift on these issues that are the bread and butter of his presidency, which are the ones that have to do with race and immigration. And that's what that's done is it's pushed Democrats and Republicans even farther apart. Now the parties are even better sorted than they were. And so, you know, in the aggregate, it looks like Americans are turning against Trump. But in what that conceals is that it's mostly the movement of Democrats. And so, that's kind of what makes the identity crisis that we use in the title of the book even more intense. Because now you can really see even more reasons why there could be intense partisan conflict on these issues.
So how much, I mean, if there was some type of baseline, right, if we're starting at zero and Obama pushes or activates, however you want to contemplate that, the sort of the racial biases of certain people, I want to say on the right, but, you know, it's also some Democrats too, right? But on the right, I guess, of the racial scale, how much further did they move from zero relative to Democrats moving the other direction from zero? Do you know what I'm saying? We're creating more polarization, but
yep.
Both parties, if there are two separate parties here, are moving to their respective corners. What was the distance that they traveled to those corners?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And actually, now I have to retreat into a very sort of carefully caveated social science kind of answer. You know, it depends on the specific kinds of questions that you're looking at, whether Democrats have moved farther to the left or Republicans have moved farther to the right. I think on questions of immigration, I think the movement of the Democratic Party has been more notable and perhaps sharper. But I think if you looked at other questions, you know, depending on the exact polling question you're looking at, you might see the opposite pattern, or you might see roughly parallel kinds of movements. So both parties are moving a similar distance. For that reason, I think we're fairly careful in not trying to say that this sorting or polarization is primarily due to movement in one party or the other. I think it's some of both, and which one looks to be moving further really just depends.
Do you have a list of like what policies have become racialized for both corners, as it were?
I mean, anything that almost anything that is connected to African Americans, connected to immigration, will show these partisan differences.
Well, I mean, I know the differences, but I mean, I mean, because it seems like what happened was during under Obama, like we started off with, you had whites without a college education come to realize that certain programs were associated with were with black people, and their attitudes, their racial attitudes kick in, and they say, well, I don't want to be I don't want to vote for a Democrat because I didn't realize that's where my money's going to. I get the sense under Trump, for instance, like that housing for the right has become even more racialized. And maybe it happened during Obama, but I get the feeling it was more racialized, and that I don't necessarily see the left as conscious about housing as a racial issue. I mean, do you have a sense of questions like that? I mean, maybe it is. I don't know, but that's just, I'm just trying to sort of draw a distinction there to see if there's anything in your data, in your research that suggests, dynamics along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think exemplifies what you're talking about is something that we refer to as racialized economics. And it's the idea that people are thinking about economic outcomes and then therefore like the government policies that affect people's economic outcomes through a racial lens. So it's not that I'm economically insecure and therefore I vote this way or that way. The really more potent perception is that my group, typically defined in terms of race and ethnicity, is losing out to those other racial groups who are getting unfair help and are not playing by the rules. And so a lot of government policies then become viewed as a sort of implicitly racial policies if they're perceived as helping undeserving people get ahead. And I think typically, especially for means-tested programs, housing, sure, if it's we're talking about like federal housing assistance for the poor, or if we're talking about any kind of social program that primarily seeks to benefit lower-income Americans, the risk is always in American politics that these policies are viewed as essentially, primarily benefiting racial and ethnic minorities who, are just living off the government and not working hard enough and trying hard enough on their own. And I think something about, certainly nothing about the 2016 campaign, changed this in any form or fashion, as far as I could tell. I feel like there was still this sort of constant division, particularly in Trump's rhetoric, between, the us, the good people, and the them. And the them often had an implicitly or explicitly racial or religious character. And so, again, to the extent that we're going to frame government policies in those terms, it's going to be, of course, increasingly difficult to reach any kinds of, agreement on those policies.
And when we're talking in generalities, but specifically, it's like white people saying, I don't want people of color to get this stuff, right? I mean, it doesn't quite go the other way.
The some of the interesting ethnographic work that was done, and it even this is before the 2016 election, definitely talking to certain groups of white Americans found exactly that perception. So one book that got a lot of attention a couple of years ago was by a sociologist named Arlie Russell Hochschild called Strangers in Their Own Land. And she went to rural Louisiana and she talked to folks there, and what she found was that they had a story that they kind of was embedded in their consciousness. And the story was, in a metaphorical sense, is I'm in line to get what I deserve, and I've worked hard and I've played by the rules, but look what's happening up ahead of me in line. Hey, who are those people? They're cutting in line. These are African Americans who benefited from affirmative action, or these are undocumented immigrants that wouldn't wait their place, and came into the country anyway. And so I think that one of the challenging things that comes out of the 2016 election, but it's clearly endemic in a lot of people's political attitudes, especially among whites, is that there's always a zero-sum game here, which where I'm doing the right thing and I'm not getting ahead, and the reason I'm not getting ahead is because they're taking it from me. And I think one of the real, nothing about the 2016 campaign makes this any better. And one of the real challenges about having a more racialized politics going forward is to try to figure out a way that we can have conversations around issues like this without having them inevitably viewed as a competition between different racial groups.
What if, what if the solution to that is to just make sure there's no line? Would these people, if these people were feeling like I'm not in line, I got to the front because it turns out there was no line. It was just like one very wide window where everybody could just walk up and get it. Do we have a sense of what would happen in that instance?
Yeah, it's almost it's a politics that's difficult to convey.
Universal, right? It's a universality. Like, this is available to everyone. We're not going
well,
to
that's,
ask
and
you.
That's why the politics of Social Security and Medicare are somewhat different, because those are, universal benefits for seniors. But of course, it's impossible to make all these. It's a challenge to make all these benefits universal. And so I think. Basically what I think is important is to make clear that I think my version of what you're saying, there's no line, is to say that to people, and this is what politicians have to try to communicate, that, the challenges that you feel that you're facing are not because of other groups. That's not who you should be attributing your own challenges to. We have to find a way to sort of sever this perception that maybe I'm not getting ahead the way I want to, or I'm not achieving what I want to achieve, from this perception that the reason for that has to be those undeserving groups over there. If we can sort of sever that link, that would be helpful in terms of, I think, of changing the way that we have conversations in and around economic security and government social policies.
I wonder if it's possible for humans ever to not blame someone else for what they feel they don't have, or they haven't gotten that they deserve. The argument about that, that we heard, I think, particularly in the context of like the Clinton and Sanders race, was sort of centered around this idea that you can try and sever that cause, that a sense that it's the fault of immigrants that you're not getting this, or it's the fault of black people that you're not getting this, or you can just try and give everybody more so that they don't even have to blame anybody. I mean, putting aside whether or not it is feasible from a practical standpoint, I'm talking from a hypothetical standpoint.
Sure.
Just in terms of social attitudes, if one is addressing who I'm going to blame, the other is addressing the beef. Right?
Yep. I think that offers an avenue. I think you're right, to having a different kind of conversation around these issues. The risk, the challenge, it seems to me, is that kind of Bernie Sanders universal argument. The question is, again, whether that's going to be met with a demagogic appeal, that's going to portray a universal policy as fundamentally a secret handout. Because my observation about the way that these debates unfold is that oftentimes, even policies that might have real benefits for, let's say, lower-income white people get portrayed as fundamentally policies that benefit African-Americans or other racial and ethnic minority groups. So the question is, can you win with a universalist argument if you have to match it up against that counter-argument? And that's like a real challenge. But I would say one of the things that we talk about at the very end of the book, we have this somewhat glimmer of optimistic note, but it's really just a glimmer, is we talk about the fact that some of the racialized politics that we observed in 2016 was due to the choices of the candidates and to the choices of political leaders more generally. And so if we're going to have any kind of politics that is where some of these issues, I don't know what you'd say, there's just a de-escalation, right? So that it doesn't feel so emotionally charged and fraught. It's going to have to come from political leaders making different kinds of appeals and finding ways to articulate, you know, policy attitudes and policy proposals that don't stoke this kind of group competition. So, I mean, if it's going to change, it's going to change in part because politicians decide they want to do it differently. I'm not confident that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well,
but that's what we think. That's what we think. That's one of the things that we think was really what made 2016 distinctive. And it's what might make a subsequent election not quite as fraught as 2016.
If I was looking at your book and I was had the ability to choose, and I don't want to, you know, I know this is sort of maybe an unfair question, but it'll be the last one and you can. But if I was looking at these attitudes and seeing what your data says that, you know, maybe like the Obama to Trump voters were at the very least, you know, in part pushed by this notion of, you know, Clinton's talking about race more than Obama did. And Trump is speaking to my pre-existing biases and I'm going to go that way. What I mean, demographically, would it be how risky? How much has things changed? Where it would be that if a an African American went up against Trump, like what would that look like? Would it be a function of like, you know, because Obama was less racial in terms of what his you know programmatically, at least what he would rhetorically than Clinton. So it, you know, maybe that's not fair, but to put it that way, but you know, it did. Just the existence of a black guy drove the Trump base sort of, I don't want to say crazy, but more crazy. So what?
I mean, and so the question. Yeah. So the question is ultimately, could this change?
Well, I mean, have attitudes changed enough that maybe we're past that danger point, or would are things? I mean, you know, I mean, did we see some of that play out maybe in races in 2016,
yeah.
in 2018? I mean, where are we in terms of the American public relative to our susceptibility to these new factors, i.e. a guy like Trump coming out and getting highly racialized and an African-American who doesn't?
That's a very good question. You know, I'm not going to give you a very optimistic answer. I don't know that we've gotten. I don't know that we've sort of passed the maximum level that we could imagine in terms of the racialization of our politics or having a more emotionally charged politics around issues like race and immigration. I thought maybe we had maxed it out in 2012 and 2008 because we had an African American on the ticket, but it turns out that we didn't. In 2016, it was even more so. And 2018, same thing. We did some analysis that looked at voters in 2018 compared to 2014-2012, and their views of immigration were now more strongly related to how they voted for Congress than they were in those two prior elections. So this is happening even in a midterm year when Trump's not on the ballot. So part of me is not sure that we're going to be able to back away from this anytime soon, given what the nature of Trump's views and the way he's basically, I see him going to continue to run his presidency and candidacy. And based on my perceptions of where Democrats are going to come from in opposing him, I think the contrasts are going to be pretty stark. So, you know, that's not the most optimistic note to end an interview on, but it really feels to me like that the conditions are still quite ripe for a continuation of what we would call the identity crisis.
John Sides, thank you so much. Fascinating work. Congratulations on it. The book is Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Battle for the Meaning of America. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam. I appreciate it, too.
Bye-bye. All right, folks.
So it's Obama's fault.
It was Obama's fault. Thanks, Obama.
Thanks for the research.
I mean, it's interesting. I remember, can't remember the name of the author now. He was a law professor at Harvard, and he had written a book about Randall Kennedy. And I can't remember the name of the book off the top of my head. But his argument was all about how Obama was constrained by his race to talk about things about race. And you know, I think there's maybe some indication that that, you know, at least from this data that, yeah, maybe had he gotten more racialized, like, you get the sense that the reason why some voters who could go from Obama to Trump were like, well, you know, I liked Obama because he talked about personal responsibility all the time. And now Hillary is just blaming white people for it. I mean, that seems to be at least, you know, part of the dynamic that was going on, at least in the context of this book. But there does, you know, it is an interesting question as to whether or not you could say people are worried that other people are cutting in front of them in line. If there was no line and everybody just had it dropped on them, maybe they would have a different.
That's the strongest point that people like Adolf Reed, you know, I think that people like he's still totally right in his critique of representational neoliberalism. And the only point that people are getting caught up in is really just debating the Trump vote. I don't think there's any contradiction between accepting that, of course, it's driven by racial, sexual, social backlash. And I still maintain that alongside specific issues, of course, to address. Maybe that's the argument people want to have. If you want to have an argument about whether there's a specific conversation and policy set dealing with race, then maybe that's a genuine argument. And I would say, yes, there absolutely has to be. But I also still maintain that universal programs are both the right thing to do and will go some ways on this stuff.
Well, I mean, that's the argument, right? It's like you're not going to cure people of their racism. You're just going to have it less activated in their life because Precisely. They're not going to have enough things to blame people for.
Well, that's true. And there is some, I mean, my understanding of even like the 60s is that part of the reason that some people were a bit more willing to move in the right direction on some aspects of social emancipation was because they were doing really well.
I mean, I know that, like, I don't go around cursing you, for instance,
right,
until there's something happens with my computer. And I'm like, what did Michael do? And so it activates
I was actually amazed by your growth Michael. Today that you didn't whine and bitch at me about your computer problems. You know what?
We did.
That's
before
a good
you came
example.
In. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, you
That's
did. So you were having no, a delusional episode. But what was good was that you were actually blaming the guy that messed up your computer, which is where the real enemy is,
right?
Versus your fucked up transference on me. So that was growth.
Well, before you came in, I had done that.
Well, I'm sure you still will have your little tantrums. But like the white electorate, we can work
on
you.
Oh, that's such a good analogy.
Yeah.
That is a great analogy. Sam is totally the white electorate of this office.
It's your fault.
The computer guy's the
Everybody's
ruling
against
us.
Me.
All right,
can
folks.
Someone get me Advil?
Everything's tailored to him, but everything's against him. You are the white electorate of the office. That is amazing.
There you go.
Total white electorate.
Okay, don't get carried away.
Keep going.
Don't get too carried away.
Sorry.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder. Oh, do we have any announcement today? We do. Oh. All right, so we have an announcement, ladies and gentlemen. Do I have a piece of paper? I have a piece of paper. On January 13th, that is exactly 2 months from today, on a Sunday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be doing a live Majority Report show as part of the Brooklyn Pod Fest. And, of course, we're obligated to do it where all the other podcast live shows are at the Bell House. Is that right?
Yes.
And So are tickets on sale now? The link is on the blog post right now. How much are the tickets? $15. We're undercutting all the other shows. Is that right? Michael, what is
Oh, yeah, you're definitely undercutting my show. There you go. But my show is going to be better.
Well, Michael's show is going
to
be better.
No, but actually, you should go to both shows. That's awesome. What's funny is I did not know that this was happening until you told me like the other day, but I'm excited. Is it just going to be us, or are we having guests? Have you decided that yet?
I'm starting to lean towards no guests, but maybe guests.
I think some people would like just Majority Report.
Maybe
show,
guests. Fun guest. Who knows? I mean, January 13th. Who knows what's going to be going on then, right? I mean, but your tickets are $15, and it's a live show. How many does it seat? How many people seat in there? 300 people?
No, it's 350. Excuse 350. Me, I think 350. Yeah.
350. So get your seats now. It's 18 and over. We're allowing the kids in, So check it out.
That's exciting. That's a big advantage.
Yeah.
Because of the time for. I'm sorry to 18-year-olds who've asked. It's a night show.
Sunday afternoon. So you know, it's not as alcohol oriented. Of course, you need to be a little bit. You need to drink a little bit and enjoy Michael's the Michael Brooks show.
Michael
so you
Brooks
know,
show.
Folks. Just a reminder. This
that was a joke.
This program. Oh, what's now? What is this?
This kind of goes with what we were talking about today. This is I'm trying to look for the source of this writer, this is but she ended up voting for DeSantis, partially because she wanted to see an end to racial divisions. In Cooper's eyes, tension between races in Madison only worsened after Obama's election in 2008. Black neighbors just started seeing everything differently, she said. They seemed consumed with Obama as the first black president and less concerned about how he was affecting the economy in Florida. That trickled down to everything, she said. Now everyone is so worried about the other race. She said she felt that a vote for Gillum, who had accused DeSantis of using a racist slur after he warned Florida's on TV to not monkey up the state, would worsen those tensions.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yep.
Exactly
big,
right.
Big tensions.
I mean, this, you know, this is like, it's all part of that sort of dynamic. You know, the loss of privilege feels like oppression. Obama up everything. Not like Trump. Trump, like, sort of, he just, like, stays in his compartment.
Yeah,
he doesn't
Trump doesn't
infuse
instigate at all.
Himself into the rest of your life.
Does not instigate.
Obama was like every day, every minute.
Obama's
what
like,
Obama time is it? What
that was
Obama
a stupid
time?
Question. Where are you from?
I'm going to
CNN. Fake
I'm
news.
Take
That's
the
fake news.
Take the Obama.
It's the white news. We call it
it's the white news. We call it the white news. Call it the devil news. Devil news. Sit down, devil news. Sit down, devil news.
That
You're
is...
a very rude person, even by devil standards. Get back to your cave, Jakob.
That is a very good snapshot of some people's extremely irrational thought patterns. And this seems to be a trend.
Oh, look, it's a racist white woman. Racist white woman.
That was
one of the stupidest questions I've ever heard in my life.
That was in the Washington Post, by the way. Election results in Florida and Georgia prompt soul searching for African Americans.
Yeah.
How are white people going to soul search when they don't have any?
Maybe it was a little bit early for us to want political representation. Maybe we should think about that.
Well, on a more sober, depressing note, do you remember there was a moment? I recall this vividly, actually, because I was studying Pakistan at the time. And in 2007, right in the Democratic primaries, I don't remember precisely when, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated in Pakistan, and it was like a big, it got an unusual amount of coverage, I would say, in the United States for an event like that. And it didn't last, but there was a slight tremor in the polls or news reporting out of South Carolina of African-American voters being like, essentially just that the image of a politician being murdered, assassinated, made them concerned and anxious about the vote for Obama. I think that kind of calculus.
The reason why Iowa
was
so important for Obama was prior to that, he did not have he had a significant support in the black community, but certainly there was major splits in the black community because they thought that he could not win. And I think there was also fears for a set. Like the thought was, there's no way this country is going to let a black guy be president. And it wasn't until he won Iowa where I think people started to believe that he could win.
Got a green light from the honkies.
There you go.
Yeah, remember
double country voted for me.
Remember when Hillary implied she wasn't going to stop campaigning because someone might shoot Obama?
Yes, I do.
That was quite the moment.
That was, yeah.
You know, when MLK and Bobby Kennedy, when they all get clipped, there's an LBJ waiting around. Subtext, subtext, subtext.
Failing to prepare is preparing to fail.
All right.
I care way too much about black people to let this black guy win.
Your support makes this show possible, folks. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Every one of your support is appreciated and extremely helpful as we can keep buying new computers that don't have Wi-Fi connections. So
upgrade to Wi-Fi.
Yeah. We're going to get this Wi-Fi. Actually, the big upgrade is we're going to actually get it tethered to an Ethernet cable. We're going back to wired.
Analog MR.
Here we
go.
That
is where things are going to go.
Pretty soon, we're going to move this whole show to recording it on a cassette tape and mailing it to you. So get ready for that, folks. In the meantime, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code remember? Majority. Get 10% off.
Sorry. Do you remember? I hope that whoever did this, I'm not hurting. And obviously, I don't even remember their name. But do you remember how they used to... the sound quality of our interviews have undoubtedly drastically improved over the last couple
of years. Yeah, I'm
trying
to upgrade it,
too. Do you remember that one guy, though, emailed us and he was like, it's a big problem listening to the sound qualities in your otherwise great interviews. And what you should do, and I'll help put invest money towards this, is you should buy a microphone and send it to your guest, and then they can send it to the next guest. this scheme that we would buy an MR mic for each of our guests, and the guests would just mail it to each other like across the world.
What we ended up doing... instead of that was, of course,
he was not messing with us.
To hire someone to actually transport the mic personally. So we have constantly I can't even remember that guy's name anymore. He's just out there just like flying around with a microphone. Yeah, but he's always a day late.
Mike, the mic delivery
guy. He's always a day late. That's what the sad part is. He shows up and they're like, I did it yesterday. He's always one day
late. That was just the most awesome email, though, because the guy really went into like, he's like, and then what will happen is the following guest will receive
the microphone. He really got upset with the quality of some interview.
The problem is some people don't have... Most people don't have landlines, and to the extent they do, it's those Volp things, and they're horrible. So, like, when we have Ben Dixon on, he's set up to do this.
Oh, yeah, he's a broadcaster.
He sounds great. But, you know, some people sound better than others. But meanwhile, today is Tuesday, Michael, and
yes.
It's almost Tuesday night already. So what,
Malika
what's happening?
Jabali will be joining us. I would say an interesting counterpoint and potential synthesis coming out of this conversation and echoing the Sunday show, which is Unlocked with Bill Fletcher Jr., which everybody should check out. Malika Jabali on the color of economic anxiety. And we're also going to be doing, as part of a preview for a larger one for patrons, a little bit of a mini illicit history of the 2000 Florida election and what's happening today and how voter suppression fits into the broader struggle for economic democracy. Did you know, I was starting to research more of this Florida 2000 thing, and I remember the big takeaways about the stolen election. But what I did not remember, or maybe just didn't even know, which makes total sense, is that a Republican Senator, Kit Bond, I don't remember what state he was from, he used the Florida election to start introducing national voter ID laws. So not only did Republicans steal the election, they used it as an impetus to actually try to do some federal interventions in voting. Just to make it harder for people to vote.
An awareness of where things were going and that they needed to start suppressing the votes.
And he would do events with a dog and a dead person, and he would say, like, I love dogs and I respect the dead, but I don't want either of them voting.
That's right.
So anyways, that's happening Friday. ContraPoint is here for a special Friday episode. Patreon.com/TMBS, Patreon.com/TMBS. And, of course, please go to both shows. We are... selling at a very steady clip for the February 1st show at the Bell House.
Jamie, the Intifada.
All right. So out now, we have our episode with Jay Firestone, who wrote an amazing piece called 3 Months Inside Alt-Right New York about his secret mission infiltrating the alt-right and what he learned from it. We also just recorded a new episode with Pavlos Rufos, author of A Happy Future is a Thing of the Past, The Greek Crisis and Other Disasters. We talked to him about the Greek debt crisis, the rise and fall of Syriza, and how it shows the limitations of bourgeois electoral politics in confronting debt and austerity, whether he thinks that's even possible to do without confronting the wage system. We also talked about some good riot stories that he, all of which he observed from very far away. And I think that's going to be a bonus for our patrons, that last part.
Matt.
Literary Hangover. We did the episode on the novel Hope, Leslie. Don't be intimidated if you're not a fiction person, because it's about 75% about history, so you can just pretend like you read the novel. We're talking about one of the themes we're tracing is the hands-onness of the patriarchy in early colonial America. So, like, literally people writing during the Pequot War, like, I noticed a large and fair Indian woman. Can I just have her? And Winthrop being like, yeah, sure, you can have her. And those documents still exist.
Wow.
And it's pretty amazing, yeah, how much of their in governorship time was spent on basically putting domestic servants into houses that they took from the Pequots, and then they would trade the men to the Caribbean for slaves. So
right. Material benefits.
Yep. For their... So in honor of Thanksgiving, you should check out the shows I'm putting out this month, guys.
All right, folks, I'm going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a look forward either tomorrow or Thursday. We're going to play an interview I just did with Marcy Wheeler last night. Catch us up. You know, we're going to see what the developments are. At any moment, we could be seeing... indictments unsealed, maybe not. Whitaker may be headed for a bit of a fall. We shall see. But either way, we'll play that because fascinating recap of what's going on. All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back, back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are...